topical discussion in ethics last week, and we want to kind of wrap it up, draw some conclusions about everything that we've studied, and then next week will be men's devotional, and the week after that we're going to start a new study. I've got an idea of where we can go in the next class, but if you have suggestions, please make them. If you want to study a topic or you'd like to study a book of the Bible, then let me know. Certainly can shift gears from what I've been focusing on, but I know you're studying here on Sunday mornings, the Holy Spirit, and so we might, if I don't get any suggestions otherwise, might do a small book of the Bible, like Ephesians, Philippians, something like that. Would just be a great book. But if you, whatever you want to study, let us know, and we can certainly develop the material for that. Be glad to do it. So we have been discussing for months now ethical issues. In fact, we started it before summer series. We always get a break in our discussion summer series, and we come back, and that was when we had sort of a introduction, and we came back and started hitting subject matter. And so we've been, for 6 or 7 months now, we've been discussing issues, ethical issues. So tonight we want to draw it to a close, to an end, and rehearse a little bit what we've talked about in principle, and then maybe do some exhortations on the way out of the study to try to help encourage all of us to do what we should in living right and being better at being moral. I think the big takeaway for us in our study has been that ethical issues are not always easy issues to navigate. There's a lot of rhetoric and cutting through whatever, smoke, whatever, to get to the central part of an issue. But I think we've seen that regardless of how complicated an issue may be, there's always an answer. We can always get to the answer on the subject. Now, that's very contrary to what our culture tells us about ethical issues. We have discussed a number of times our culture is very relativistic, it's very humanistic, and so that leads to the sort of the general theory that there's no such thing as truth, you never can really know truth, and so when it comes to moral issues, most people in the world say, you do whatever you believe is right because that's where you're, that's your barometer, you know, for testing whatever's valid or not valid. So it's an issue of truth. There is such a thing as truth. John chapter 8, Jesus explained that in John chapter 8. If someone would read verses 31 and 32 for us, please. Okay. When Jesus said, you shall know the truth and the truth will make you free, obviously there's some lessons to be learned there. What are some of the implications of that statement? What are some of the principles we get out of that statement? Okay, you can know what's true. So whatever is true is knowable. It can be discovered. It can be perceived. What else? Anything else that's implied there? Okay, singular. And I think that's also, maybe those are the two great takeaways here. It's knowable, it's doable, and whatever's knowable or doable is, it's very exclusive, it's singular. There is the truth. There are no versions of truth. It's just the truth. And, you know, maybe we could illustrate it, you know, mathematically, if we keep it simple. If you have zero and you add zero to zero, what do you get? You get zero. I mean, that's a mathematical truth. You know, you have zero, you add nothing to it, you get zero. You have one and you add one to it, you get two. That is an irrefutable truth, right? In the same way, the same God that made the scientific truth, and you know, we get mathematical truth, it's the same God that gives us moral and spiritual truth. And His truth is not up for, you know, varying interpretations and all. It's just the truth. It's whatever it is. And so if the sky is up and the ground is down, that's truth, and that never changes. In the same way, the spiritual moral truth never changes, and it's discernible. So whatever there is, whatever issue we run into, there is truth. There is the truth, and it can be found. Same book, John chapter 18, there was a discussion between Jesus and Pontius Pilate. And Pilate says, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Verse 33. Jesus answered him, "Are you speaking for yourself on this, or did others tell this to you about me?" You know, is this something you're interested in personally, or are you just regurgitating information? Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and chief priests have delivered you to me. What have you done?" Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews, but now my kingdom is not from here." Pilate therefore said to him, "Are you a king then?" Jesus answered, "You rightly say that I'm a king. For this cause I was born, for this cause I've come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth." So Jesus mentions it there. "Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." And of course Pilate says, "Well, what is truth?" So this big discussion, this big philosophical discussion takes place over truth. But Jesus is making clear that there is such a thing as truth, the truth. And like Joel was saying, it's we can know it, we can know the truth. So when we run into ethical issues, no matter how much whipped cream and cherry is on top, because of how much culture, you know, puts the whipped cream and cherry on top, so to speak, we can still cut through all that and get to the truth of the issue. So there, the issue is discernible. What if there is no specific answer? How do we do that? If someone says, "Hey, what about?" And it's over the course of the weeks, you know, sometimes people come up and they say, "What about this scenario?" And there's a lot of issue and hypothetical involved in it. So what if I can't turn to the Bible and say, the Bible doesn't even say anything about genetic engineering or in vitro fertilization or this specific instance of gambling or whatever. What if I cannot find a specific verse that says, thou shalt not or thou shalt? What do I do? Yeah, Art. Right. That's right. Okay. So there are basic principles in the Bible, like Matthew 7:12 and other Bible verses, that present a principle, and those principles are true, and they will guide us to a reasonable conclusion about all of these subjects. They will do that. So even if there's no specific answer, how big would the Bible have to be, by the way, if God throughout time in advance treated every single specific issue and gave a specific thou shalt or thou shalt not for every single scenario that man would face? Would the books fit in this room? They would never fit. What was the most concise way to do that? To do like Art was saying, to give us answers in principle, to give us the mind to discern a principle, or maybe give us an example where something is at work, and then for us to take and then make application of that principle in the future. So these ethical issues get really tough because, you know, somebody will say, "Well, I don't. Well, is it okay to do DNA testing, or can I do, in vitro testing and all that? Where's the Bible say anything about that?" Well, let's look at principles. Yeah, Art. Yeah, that's right. It does. I think that's right, and I think that's keep it simple, and everybody can remember the simple, and then you can make application of those principles. And I think that's certainly true spiritually. So what we've seen is, you know, we've dealt with the issue of war, which is ongoing, and policemen and servicemen, can Christians do that? Those are very complicated issues. The Bible has answered. There are principles in the Bible that would tell us that. What about drug use or abuse? You know, we talked about that last week. Well, it may not address every single specific scenario or drug, but the Bible gives us principles to guide our way to an answer. Yeah, Tom. I think so. I believe so. Mm-hmm. I think so. I believe so. And, you know, we have examples in the Bible too, where God reacted to situations, and there's principles embedded in the way that he reacted to those situations. So we either have the principle presented, there's some sort of truth presented, and the principles embedded in that truth, or we have a situation where God interacted with human beings that were doing something similar that we can take maybe an update through technology or whatever. We can say, here's his feeling on that. So that's certainly the case. So I think we've seen that in this class. So here's the part B of that. Should we be, as servants of God and the light of the world, should we stay morally educated? Should we stay up on issues? And I see people doing this, and I agree with you. Why should we do that? What's the importance of that? Okay. What is the mission of the Lord's church? What is our mission? What's our charge? That's what we're supposed to do, is make disciples. I mean, it's likely that it's easy to forget that because we get caught up in life and we forget that that's what... You know, our mission is not just to assemble on Sundays and Wednesdays. That's not our mission. We have an actual mission statement that says, here's what I want you to do. Now, part of your service involves coming together and worshiping, and you can charge your batteries and have fellowship, and you can honor me in your worship, but I've got a job for you to do, and your job is to go out in the world and make disciples out of everybody in the world. What's the reason for that? Why does God want us to do that? Yeah, he's interested in the salvation of mankind. Sent his son to die for everybody. So everybody in the world, they've got a soul and it's at stake, and God wants everybody to be saved. And his unit for getting the message that saves out to the world is the church. We are his evangelistic machine, as we're supposed to be anyway. Matthew 28, 18 through 20, you know, we're supposed to be going out making disciples of all the nations. So it is inevitable that as we go out and we engage people in our culture, in this area within the American culture, that we're going to run into situations that are very unique to our culture and even to this geographic area, and we have to be up on that. Otherwise, we're going to be at a loss for engaging people in discussion. Any thoughts on that? Yeah, Bob. Yes. Mm-hmm. I think so. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. There's some wisdom to that principle, you know, about staying up. You know, there's even I think it's 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 11, maybe, where Paul says, of the devil, he says, we are not ignorant of his devices. We know what he's up to. We know we kind of keep a pulse on what's going on. I think that's the principle there. Let's turn to 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3. Would someone read verse 15? 1 Peter 3:15. Okay, so there's a couple things. You know, at the very last part of it, he's talking about there's an attitude that Christians should have and the way that they present answers. But what's this verse about? In fact, if you're familiar with 1 Peter, what's the general context of 1 Peter? What's going on with Christians in 1 Peter? Yeah, what's life like for Christians around this time? They are suffering. In fact, almost all of chapter 4 is about how Christians are being persecuted and they're suffering. And right in the middle of that, he says, now be ready. Be ready to give an answer. And that's what Travis was just saying. You got to be ready to give an answer, because in the middle of all of this suffering, somebody's going to say, why are you even doing this? Why are you even trying to put up a fight? Why are you even trying to stay by Christianity? Why do you say you have allegiance to the Lord if it means it's going to cost you getting sawn in half or getting dipped in tar and set on fire alive, lighting up, you know, the road to the city of Rome? Why would you even do that? And a Christian has to be prepared to give that answer. And that's the whole point of verse 15, is that before it ever takes place, before the question is asked, we try to be as ready as we can be Obviously with the right motivation in doing that. But there's part of this idea of we kind of have to keep up with what's going on. Christians should never have their heads buried in sand. And when someone says, hey, there's an issue that's affecting your children, and you say, I didn't know, you know. Now, that's not to say that something might not ever take us by surprise, but it is to say that it's wrong to turn a blind eye and refuse to learn what's going on in our culture, because we can help people with Bible answers to that. I always think about Paul. Remember Paul goes up to, he's in the city of Athens and goes up, he's at Mars Hill, and he goes, I was passing all these inscriptions, and I noticed an inscription to the unknown God. And then he starts to engage them about, you know, philosophically things they were thinking about. And then he starts quoting, it says, as also some of your own poets have said, and begins to, and what he's doing is expressing how knowledgeable he was of their culture. Do you think that appealed to them? It did, because at the end of that section, it said many, both men and women, believed. And then there were some who said, we're going to hear you again on this. And what he did was he engaged them at their level of understanding, and it affected them. Some were actually converted as a result of that. So it's good for us to stay up on things. Now, this is just totally, it's connected, but it is an individual response type of thing. Where do you go and get information? How do you find out about, like, you know, trends taking place, like Bob was talking about, things going on culturally, morally? Where have you found to be a good source to do that so others can know about that as well? Well, yeah, the news. But yeah, I mean, there are reports. Even if there's bias in whatever way, you know, there's bias in reporting, somebody can say, here's this, and you can still get an idea that there's something is trending morally, spiritually taking place. How else have you? Yeah, I think so. You can always tell by the way people are posting or what they're posting if there's an issue sort of trending socially and morally, and you can kind of and then that would be a good time to say, hey, maybe I need to start reading up on that, study on that. What's up?
For people with young families.
Yeah. Yeah. Kids are going to talk about the things that they're impacted by. You know, they're going to do that. And especially, like, for example, as your children get to you know, your preteen and teenage years, when they're in school and they're very impacted by, you know, the social influences in school and peers and such, they're going to know what's going on morally and ethically in schools and around their friends. And so we can, I think Tommy's right, listen to the kids and listen to the things in the family. Any other sources that you can think of that are good sources? Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think everybody, you know, I know when Ashley did floor work when she was in Park Ridge Hospital, it was almost every day she'd come home and say all the nurses were talking about, and you could almost tell what their interest was in some social and moral issue. And so it would be an easy way to keep up with that, because people talk about that. So just keeping our ears open, I think, is a good thing. But I think it's good for us to stay morally educated. Is there a value in reading books besides the Bible? There's a good value in that, right? And it's certainly not wrong to get a book and read a book, maybe just dealing with topical matters like that to kind of keep up with what's going on. But and then I think maybe together, because we need to be conversing more about things like that, if you find a good book and you say, this was a great book on a certain subject, let me know about it. I'd like to read that. And maybe, you know, we can do the same and say, there's an issue going on and I found a great book about that, and this is a very helpful book. But we need to stay morally up on things. Here's the third thing tonight that at the end of our discussion on ethics, it seems to kind of stand out. People are known by what they stand for or don't stand for. That's how people are known. You can strip away all the other, you know, extremities of a person's character, and you will be remembered, and I will be remembered by what I stood for or what I didn't stand for in life. And I'm thinking, there are a couple of Bible examples that just stand out where men or women stood up and they did something morally right, and they're known forever because they did what was morally right. Let's go back to Genesis 39. Genesis 39. chapter 39. Now, there's an interesting timeline in Genesis. Chapter 38 is not the immediate continuation of chapter 37, because chapter 37, Joseph gets sold by his brothers into slavery. He's taken down to Egypt. And there's chapter 38 that happens with Judah and Tamar. We have that story between that. And then the story picks back up with Joseph in chapter 39. Even though Joseph is he's really the sort of the central figure all the way to the end of the book, there's a little gap in the time. And we pick up now the story in Genesis 39 with Joseph in Egypt. So verse 1 says, Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard of an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph. He was a successful man. He was in the house of his master, the Egyptian, and his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight, served him, that he made him overseer of his house, all that he had put under his hand. So obviously he's a terrific, faithful steward. God, through Joseph, was demonstrating himself. They were in fellowship with each other, and Potiphar recognized the brilliance and the faithfulness of this young man. He trusted him. There's a problem, though. Verse 6. So he had left all that he had in Joseph's hand. He did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. And Joseph was handsome in form and appearance, just a faithful young man, and obviously, you know, great in good looks and all that. Verse 7. Came to pass after these things that his master's wife, casting long eyes on Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." Now, what she's asking there, she said, we got a lot of beds. It's nap time. Why don't we go take a nap? All of us are going to go take a nap. Is that what she's asking? What's the import here? Yeah, let's go commit fornication. Come on, let's go. And this is something apparently she does every day. Verse 8, he refused and said to his master's wife. And his response, of course, is what we all should say in a similar situation. Look, my master does not know what is with me in the house. He's committed all that he has to my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? So it was, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her. He said no every time, to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time, when Joseph went into the house to do his work, none of the men of the house was inside, that she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand, fled, and ran outside. And that's how we remember him. Now, there are a lot of other things that happen in Joseph's life, but if we ask anybody, can you tell us something about Joseph? And everybody remembers that while he may have become, you know, high-ranking member of the Egyptian hierarchy, he's the boy, the young boy, who resisted temptation and ran without his outer cloak out of Potiphar's house because Miss Potiphar was trying to get him to commit fornication, and he refused to do it. And that's how we remember him, because he stood for something. Of course, we love his response. It's a reasoned response, right? She goes, "Commit fornication with me." He said, "Well, I can't do it because, number one, you're his wife. You don't belong to me. He trusts me, and I'm not going to invalidate his trust by committing fornication with you. And beside all that, I'm not going to sin against God in doing it." It was just a super mature response on the part of this young man. That's how we know him, right? And that's how we are going to be known. People are going to say, we either stood for something or we did not stand for something. That's how we're going to be known in life. So either we're going to be like Joseph because we were upright and virtuous and moral, or we're not going to be remembered that way. How about Esther chapter 1? Sometimes we don't use this example, but this is a great example too. Esther chapter 1. It's interesting, in the book of Esther, there are two queens. Esther's the second one and the primary object of the story. But there's another one first, a queen, Vashti. And she's married to Ahasuerus, who eventually marries Esther. And she gets mentioned down here a little bit in verse 5. When the days, these days were complete, there was a big conquest of some land. The king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan, the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen and purple and silver rods and marble pillars, and the couches were of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise, and white and black marble. It's just ornate, beautiful. Can't imagine how gorgeous it was to see all of that. Verse 7, they served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other, with royal wine in abundance, according to the generosity of the king. So they were just having a big party in accordance with the law. The drinking was not compulsory, for so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. Then verse 9, Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women in the royal palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine. Now, you know, it's sort of poetic language, but what's it basically saying? They've been drinking for a while. What was their state like? They were drunk. They were sauced. You know, they've been drinking for a while, and they were very drunk on wine. He commanded Mahuman, and he goes through all of the other presidents, people who were there present. It says, to verse 11, to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown, in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. Now, there's an implication in the language. When it says that she's to come in wearing her crown, there's some debate over this, but the likelihood is, what's he asking her here? Wearing only the crown. My wife's gorgeous. I want you to see her body, and I want you to know it's the queen. She's going to come in with her crown, and she's going to display her body before these drunken men. And in verse 12, what does she do? I'm not doing it. She refused to come at the king's command brought by his eunuchs. Therefore, the king was furious, and anger burned within him. Now, he asks her to do something that is not moral. And she says, no. And there's just a glimpse of Vashti in history. This is the only record we have of her. It's the only kind of glimpse in the Bible we have of her. But that glimpse is great because she's known by what she stood for. And so that's what we all need to do, is to be known for something. There was a man by the name of Edmund Burke many years ago who said, all that's necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing. And spiritually and morally, there has to be the light of the world. And that's us. We are the light of the world. We're the salt of the earth. And so we're going to be known by what we stand for. So we go through all these moral issues. It's not just arbitrary. We're about to explore that in Romans 12. It's not just arbitrary. We're doing it because it's supposed to be part of who we are. And we're going to be known by what either we stood for or against. Yeah, fall for anything. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That's sort of Romans 2:32 there, or Romans 1:32, about you know you're either condoning it or you're against it. So, you know, sort of the same thing. All right, so let's finish with this last thought. Let's turn to Romans chapter 12. Romans 12, and then we'll draw our ethics class to a close. Romans 12. So being moral is, in making good decisions morally, it's not just some sort of a arbitrary, static sort of a thing, and it's, you know, it's just, we just do it because, you know, God doesn't want me doing this, and I can't do it. I would do it if God let me do it, but He won't let me do it. It's not that way. As a Christian, making these types of decisions is supposed to be, it's part of who we are now. It's just, those are the choices we make because of how we've been changed in that regard. Right.
And he said in one record about the debate, he was saying that if you really believe in God and you trust in God, then you know that whatever vow or decision God makes is logically deduced.
Right.
So you should be able to go out and logically think
about it.
Yeah,
I think so. Yeah, I think so. So let's look at verses 1 and 2. I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. So here's sort of this is the Bible summary for everything that we've discussed for the last however many months that we've been talking about morality and ethics and things of that sort. Before Paul, by inspiration, gets to the way that we're supposed to change and the way we react, he gives us the motivation for it all. He gives us the reason why we do everything that we do. And he says, I beseech you, brethren, therefore, by what? The mercies of God. Now, what's that mean? What are the mercies of God? Everything he's promised? Any other thoughts? What's the mercies of God? Yeah. I think that's it. I think, you know, what he's promised, what he gives us, I think that's exactly right. Back in the preceding chapters, really about chapter 9, 10, and 11, he was talking about, you know, God made choices to bring about redemption. And he sort of concludes that, Paul does in chapter 12, by saying, now, based on those mercies. But ultimately, where do those mercies culminate? What's the ultimate climax of the mercies of God? The cross of Christ, right? Is that supposed to be the motivation for everything I do? It should be. I hope that it's always that for me and for, you know, for you too. I hope that whatever we're doing, it's because Jesus gave his life for me. And so when we're making a choice, when someone says, hey, do you want to do some drugs? Or do you want to do, do you want to do something? And it's not ethical. It's not a choice that's moral. It's not that we don't say, well, I can't do it because God won't let me do it. That's not why we're saying that. We're going to say, I don't want to be involved in that kind of behavior because Jesus died for me. And that death has changed me, and I don't live like that anymore. I'm not going to do that anymore because his death has made me a different person. And that's why Paul then begins to explain how that comes out practically, but it's the mercies of God that motivate us to be the way that we are. So then he starts in chapter 12, and he talks about this presentation that we're making. He says that you present your bodies, living sacrifice. And one of the things we're going to start talking about at Sunday morning, we're going to start a series on Sunday mornings, for the next couple of weeks, talking about the Christian priesthood, because we probably don't think of ourselves as priests very often, but we are priests, and this is the idea here, because that's what a priest does. He presents sacrifices. That's what we're going to be talking about for the next couple of weeks. So here's this presentation. So let's talk about some of the characteristics of this presentation, because this is what a moral life looks like. This is how it works. What are some things you notice in verse 1 about this presentation that we're making? What are the characteristics of it? It is an active, constant presentation. That would be opposed to sort of the invalid sacrifices of old, but this is something that we're doing every single day. So this is a daily presentation that we're making to the Lord. What else do you see? What is it? Okay, it comes out in service. There's a reasonable or spiritual service. That's kind of the idea that we're presenting this with the understanding that it has practical value. We see how it works out in real life. What else do you see about it? What's another quality of it? Holy. What's that mean? What's holy mean? Without sin? Sorry, I kind of interrupted you there. Yeah, pure. It's the idea of something that is like verse 2. It's not like the world. We are trying to be different than the world is. The world says live one way. God says live another way. Is this a free will offering, or is it just forced? Free will, right? And when he says present, is that something made? We do this collectively, or we do it individually? It is both. We do as a congregation, but there's an individual choice that each of us makes to do this. We're all individually making this choice. It's to be acceptable. And in other words, God is the recipient of that. We're not doing it for me. We're doing it because God wants that. We're doing it for Him. So there's a lot of involved in this. And then in verse 2, he limits that. He says, now here's how it's not supposed to be. He says, and do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So the limitation is that we're not supposed to be like the world. I hope that when people look at me and my behavior, and all of us have to do this, right, that people don't look at me and say, he's just like the world. He's just like everybody else. I want people to know something different about me. Not in the sense of people saying, well, he's just a weird guy. You know, I want them to say, you know, there's something, the way he thinks about things, the way he acts, the way he reacts, there's something different about that guy. He's motivated by something. And I want them to see in me that I'm motivated by the death of Jesus. And I hope all of us want to be that way. Instead, we're supposed to be transformed into the image of God. And that's what Bible ethics is really all about. It's about trying to live right because God gave himself for us, and we're trying to please him. And by doing that, we're supposed to be the light of the world. We can draw people in, and we try to have Bible answers for it. But for whatever other issue there may be in the future that we're impacted by morally and spiritually, let's try to stay up on top of that and study and learn and try to help the world through that. And just great, great thoughts. I appreciate all your input in this class. If you've got suggestions, something that you've been thinking, I wish we could study, tell that to me. Let us know, or let one of the elders know. We can talk about it tomorrow night when we come together. But sure would love to have your input, because if it's something that you need and would be helpful for you, I'd be glad to know what that is. So thank you very much for your study and your help on ethics. Really appreciate it.